Democratic state lawmakers and progressive criminal justice advocates, one big bit of unfinished business in recent years that remains on the docket for this year is legislation dealing with the rights of minors while in police custody, including their right to remain silent. In light of this outstanding measure, we wanted to highlight a recent state court of appeals ruling that considered a 19-year-old's right to call their attorney. To explain the decision and discuss what it tells us about the state's top court, we're joined in the studio by Rob Rosbro, author of the New York Appeals blog at nysappeals.com and a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Welcome back to the show, Rob.
Thanks for having me back, David.
So can you give us the backstory of Malik Dawson, who was the subject of a April 2022 ruling from the State Court of Appeals?
Sure. So Mr. Dawson was picked up by the police and put in an interrogation room for about 2 hours before the detectives who were going to be questioning him came in to ask him some questions about an alleged sexual assault. So in that time, he had his phone confiscated from him, and when the detectives came in, they started with a colloquy about, do you know what your Miranda rights are? And the Miranda rights are the warnings that the police have to give criminal defendants before they talk to them to make sure that the defendants understand what rights they might be giving up by talking to the police. So it's the right to remain silent and all the other rights you hear
we've
on Law &
Order. We've seen Law & Order. That's
to say. Right.
Okay, we went for the same joke. Good, 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 good.
So if you've seen Law & Order, you know what the Miranda rights are. Here, what the detectives asked Mr. Dawson was, do you understand your rights? And he said, yeah, definitely. I wish that I knew my lawyer's number so I could call him. It's in my phone. Can I have my phone? The detective twice acknowged that Mr. Dawson wanted to call his lawyer, but then after a period of time came back in and said, you know what, you can either talk to your lawyer now or you can talk to me and maybe we can work this out. And Dawson eventually, after that colloquy, said, okay, let's see if we can resolve this, and waived his right to remain silent and talk to the police. All of that was used against him in the criminal trial, and that's what formed the basis for the appeals.
So I've definitely seen either Law & Order or other maybe more realistic cop shows where once the person who's in custody even hints at that fact they want a lawyer, there's usually somebody, often in a supervisory role, who says, all right, we got to get out of here. We got to cut him loose. We can't keep questioning him, or we got to get his attorney present. Why wasn't that the case here?
So in New York, the rule is even a little bit stronger than what you typically see on Law & Order. So in New York...
I love that we're just keeping referring to Law & Order. This is fantastic. Keep going.
So in New York, once a defendant says that unequivocally evokes the right to remain silent and speak to a lawyer, the questioning has to stop and nothing can be used against the defendant after that point unless the defendant waives that right in the presence of the lawyer that they've requested. So that's a little bit different than what you would see under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. But so it's a stronger right here in New York. And what the difference in this case was is that the majority of the Court of Appeals looked at what happened and said, well, this wasn't an unequivocal invoke of the right to remain silent and the right to a counsel. He said he sort of was questioned back and forth and was wavering a little bit. And because there's a record support for that determination by the appellate division, then we don't have any further power to review it. It was a very limited standard of review by the Court of Appeals here, but what the dissent says is that's an overly technical view of it. Twice Mr. Dawson invoked his right to remain silent and to speak to an attorney, and twice the detective who was questioning him acknowledged that fact. And after that, the only way that right could have been waived is in the presence of the counsel.
Is it surprising that an appellate court would interpret the state's protections so narrowly?
So, yes and no. So it's surprising because New York has a much stronger right to the right to counsel than the federal constitution. But with there have been a number of Court of Appeals decisions over the years, and they're chronicled in the dissenting opinion in this case, how the courts have found even statements like, I think I want a lawyer, or I should get a lawyer, or something like that, to not be equivocal, as being an unequivocal right or invocation of the right to counsel, after which nothing can be used. So this is what the dissent sees and what a lot of the progressive criminal justice reform advocates see as a eroding away of New York's strong protection of the right to counsel.
And what ended up happening to Malik Dawson?
So Malik Dawson's conviction was upheld, and he's going to prison because of the fact that all of the information that he gave after he waived, unequivocally waived the right to counsel, or so the majority said, was used against him in his criminal trial.
So this current court is made up entirely of appointees from Governor Andrew Cuomo and Governor Kathy Hochul. So how, if at all, do you feel like the makeup of the court informed this ruling?
So this ruling is hard to say because it ended up being 5-2 with five judges agreeing with the majority based upon the limited standard of review that this was not an unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel, and two dissenting. And the two dissenting are the ones who are typically dissenting in a lot of the court's cases. That's Judges Rowan Wilson and Judge Jenny Rivera. What we've tended to see since Judge Troutman, Shirley Troutman, was put on the court by Governor Hochul, is there's been a division of the court in a way that has one or two judges sitting in the middle in almost every case. Mm. So on one side, you have, the block who looks at the law like Chief Judge DeFiore, Judge Shingis, and Judge Garcia. All former prosecutors. And on the other side, you have Judge Rivera and Judge Wilson. And in the middle sit the two of the newest ones, Judge Canatero, who really seems to be the swing justice because in every case, he's voted with the majority. And all that really means is he's the one whose vote casts the most in these divisions. And Judge Troutman, who tended to side with Judge Wilson and Judge Rivera in some cases, but it's very early because she's only been on the court for a few months.
Because the case with Malik Dawson had such a limited standard, is it unfair to assume that the judges with prosecutorial backgrounds made their decisions based on their backgrounds? Or because of the limited scope, this is kind of a unique case and we shouldn't read in too much into the decisions?
I think many will probably disagree with me, but I think this is a very limited standard of review. And so all the court's job was to see if there was support in the record for the appellate division's finding. The court wasn't going to make new findings or make its own determination on its own, which is what the dissent would have had it do. So because this is a very limited standard review, I think this is hard to extrapolate to say, well, in every other case, you're going to have these blocks. But it does seem to suggest, if you consider the redistricting case that just came out of the Court of Appeals, you had a very similar block where you had four in the majority. Judge Troutman agreed that there was a procedural violation of the redistricting constitutional provision, but then sided with the dissent on what the remedy should be. So in that kind of case, you see the divisions with Judge Canatero really in the middle, and Judge Troutman is a sort of swing one way or the other, but it's hard to extrapolate from the Dawson case in particular, given the very limited standard of review.
Well, when it comes to the redistricting case, and I imagine the Dawson case as well, liberal activists have said that the ruling highlights the idea that we have a conservative-leaning Court of Appeals, even though all of the justices were appointed by Democratic governors. Would you say we have a conservative majority based on these types of rulings, or does it just indicate a more restrained judiciary as opposed to a more activist one?
I think it's definitely more of a restrained judiciary rather than a conservative court. I think the differences here are not political differences, but differences in how they view the law and how to apply it. You know, for example, Judge Garcia was the deciding vote in the Forever Wild case that came out of the Court of Appeals last year. And in that, it was in upholding the Forever Wild protections based upon his interpretation of the Constitution. So I really think it's a legal theory, a legal interpretation divide more than it is a political one.
And have there been other criminal cases that have made it before the state's top court where you can look at the opinions and the breakdown in votes and see that where everyone shook out is based on their background and their experiences before joining the Court of Appeals?
You know, the criminal cases are the hardest that case to make that this is not sort of you look at what the judges' backgrounds are and then how they're going to view the law. Because when you have three judges from a prosecutorial perspective, they're going to view the law a little bit differently than would, for example, Judge Wilson and Judge Rivera, who don't have that background and have a more of a social justice type background for Judge Rivera in particular. So for the way that the court views cases and criminal cases in particular, it may be that the former prosecutors will look at the case a little bit more deferentially to the people. But in the end, I think it's really the way they view the law that how these cases end up with judges Canatero and Troutman really pulling their sway to decide how the cases ultimately end up coming out.
This court case involving Malik Dawson, is this a rare criminal case that has actually made it before the Court of Appeals? Because I know there has been a knock on the court in recent years that it isn't taking up a lot of appeals dealing with criminal cases. Or is this some sort of outlier from that process? And even though it is a criminal case, it doesn't fall under that umbrella?
I don't think it's a criminal appeal unique issue. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the way the court has taken appeals and decided appeals over the last 10 years, it was taking and deciding a lot more appeals, civil and criminal, 10 years ago than it is now. So now in the last year, it's decided probably about between 60 and 80 appeals, whereas it was deciding about 200 to 300 10 years ago. So it's the difference, I think, is the court is taking a lot fewer appeals and deciding a lot fewer appeals. So you're seeing a lot less criminal appeals, but you're also seeing a lot less civil appeals at the same time.
Is it a good or bad thing for the court to hear fewer appeals?
I don't think it's particularly a good thing. I think that there are a lot of issues that are ripe for the decision by the Court of Appeals that could provide some certainty in the law, and it would be beneficial for it to take more cases. And particularly, we have an issue in the legal profession where there are a lot of women advocates and advocates of underrepresented groups from law schools that aren't getting the chance to argue in court because oral arguments are going away. And with the Court of Appeals taking fewer cases, they're getting less opportunities. So it goes beyond even just the cases itself to the opportunities you have to different types of lawyers to argue before our state's highest court that decides what the law is going to be in New York.
Well, we've been speaking with Rob Rosbro. He's the author of the New York Appeals blog, which you can find at nysappeals.com. And he's a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Thank you so much, Rob.
Thanks again for having me.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.